Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. I'm having a Skype conversation with Jay Newton Small. She has been covering Washington since 2002, reporting on the White House, Congress, and four presidential campaigns. Broad influence, her first book grew out of her Time story in October 2013 about the women of the Senate coming together during the government shutdown to help move Congress forward. She lives in Washington, D.C. In 2016, she founded MemoryWell. It's a digital platform for senior storytelling for those who are experiencing Alzheimer's and dementia. And you heard a lot about it when in our first conversation when she was talking about her experience with her dad and how she saw a gap in the marketplace for instead of filling out a lot of paperwork to be able to craft someone's story so that they have a good experience when they're in a memory care facility. And she's got writers. Let's see, you've got 650 writers, four full-time people and five part-time people who are helping write people's stories.
Exactly.
Awesome. So welcome to the program.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah. And we've got a sponsor today. Everyone hates doing the books for their business except for Sally Doyle and some other great bookkeepers. She owns Absolute Business Solutions. She has trustworthy bookkeepers who love crunching the numbers for small business owners and entrepreneurs so that you can sleep more soundly knowing every dollar in your business is 100% accounted for. You're freed up to do the work that you're good at and keep leading. So to set up a free consultation, you can call Sally at 1-651-208-8151, or you can connect with her at absolute-business-solutions.com. She's a great profit strategist, bookkeeper, and she's also an innovative thinking, so she'll understand your thinking in addition to doing the practical things of taking care of your numbers. All right, so we left off in our conversation with we kind of segued from your book because we were talking about your parents and your experience with them. And the book came out of broad influence, how women are changing the way America works, came out of your experiences with your mom and seeing and your own experiences and the disparity between her work life and yours. Is that a good description of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
did you want me to say it again, or is it?
No, it's great. Yeah, no, it's great. Yes, and your dad passed away from Alzheimer's in 2016, and you had 5 years between when your mom passed away and when your dad passed away, where you took care of your dad and saw what it's like for someone experiencing the loss of their memory and the ability to really take care of themselves and their friendships and the social network and how it's impacted, that it prompted you to, do the work that you're doing right now and put together a grant for a clinical trial to measure the impact on behavioral issues and calming and empathy building and really capturing the caregiving stories in a way that people feel they're cared about and other people can care for them better and connect with them in different ways about their past because they still have their past memories.
Yeah, it really brings the person into the center of the care rather than the diagnosis.
Yeah. Did your dad have his memory of his younger years until he passed away?
Not for the last couple of years. The last 2 years, I think he really acting to much at all. But he, for the first 3 years and I was caregiving for him, he certainly remembered his younger years, particularly for a while, his time in Africa and his time in Australia, his time in Europe. So in that sense, you know, being able to, there's an expression in Alzheimer's and dementia that you meet them where they are. And so being able to meet him where he was, you know, being able to understand where in his sort of previous life or timeline where he was, and then kind of figuring out what music he liked that era and playing that for him, which would always get him to react, or figuring out what, you know, what movies he liked, things like that. And then also old photos. So being able to really engage him where he was. And we have this sort of timeline function as part of our stories that grew out of that, where, you know, people can add a whole timeline, build out a whole timeline of their loved one's life as attached to the stories, because the stories are relatively brief and they see all the things families then want to add to them. They see all the things that we've missed. Uncle Joe wants to add the time when they went ice fishing in Michigan and whatever hilarity ensued. And so we enabled these timelines so that people could really meet people where they are. So if I knew, for example, that my dad was back in his 20s, and then I knew he would be listening to Bert Kempfer and the Beatles and the Monkees, and, you know, so I would bring those things with me, and having that timeline there with all of their favorite things at that time at your fingertips really enables you to kind of meet them where they are all the quicker.
Wow. So if someone was going to work with one of your writers, how would they go about doing that?
Well, if you just go to our website, memorywell.com, you can sign up. There's a button on the top left hand, or top right hand side, where you can buy a memory well of your own and buy a story for your loved one. And it doesn't even have to be for somebody who has Alzheimer's and dementia. This holiday season, we had a lot of people who asked for stories just because their grandma or grandpa or whatever senior in their life had a great story that they wanted to capture, whether they fought in World War II or survived the Great Depression, and just really wanted to have them interviewed to talk about these amazing life experiences and capture that before it was too late. So you can just go to memorywell.com, and we'd love to tell your loved one's stories.
Great. I don't know of anyone else who's doing this kind of work.
Yeah, most of the other solutions I would say on the market are kind of do-it-yourself. So it's you buy like a digital kind of questionnaire, and then you kind of have to kind of figure it out yourself. And I think that, you know, we chose specifically not to do it that way because, frankly, of my experience filling out that questionnaire for my dad, you know, yeah, we're all so close to our loved ones. How do you begin to capture their life? How do you begin to sort of say, oh, this is important and this isn't important? And it's very daunting. I think it's a lot easier to have somebody interview you. They can write something that's with a little bit of distance and perspective, and then you can really then build on it and build up this timeline. And I think that that's a lot easier for people rather than feeling like this pressure to answer these questions and these questionnaires, you know, even digitally, it's hard. That's why we chose to do it with writers, because we felt that it really brought some great perspective and some great storytelling to it too. So really the stories are all really lovely, and we really take pride in the fact that we're writers, and we really celebrate the art and the craft of writing.
Yeah. Who knew? When you were studying journalism, where this would lead. That is just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Different.
Yeah, it's very different, but really, I mean, it's like, well, of course, you know, why wouldn't we want writers to help us capture the memories and the beauty within our relationships? Yeah, it makes so much sense now that you've, you know, put it together.
Well, thanks. I hope so. So, we'd love to, yeah, it's still very nascent and new, but we're still trying to convince people it's a good idea, but hopefully more and more people will think like you and think it's an interesting, cool thing to do.
Yeah. Well, and another aspect of your life is writing Broad Influence, and it was published in 2016, so after the last, during the last election.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading the inside cover of the book to give a full understanding to the listeners about how women are reshaping our world. Against the backdrop of a historic election in 2016, Time correspondent Jay Newton Small presents a compelling picture of how politics and culture are transformed as women begin to exert broad influence. When women reach between 20% and 30% of any organization, whether it's the legislature, a Navy ship, or a corporate board, they begin to change how things are done. America is finally reaching that critical mass led by the women of Washington. So for the first time, there are more than 100 women serving in Congress. And we had mentioned in our last conversation that some among the most powerful members, 38% are in the Democratic Party and 23% in the Republican Party. When women lead some of the largest corporations of the United States, including General Motors, IBM, and PepsiCo, they are four-star generals, police chiefs, and in positions of influence throughout the cabinet, in diplomatic ranks, and in the courts. In this insightfully reported exploration of the workplace, inside the Beltway and beyond, Newton Small reveals how an influx of women in an organization not only makes it more receptive, a receptive place for its female members, but fundamentally changes how it operates. Such groups are typically better at collaborating, listening, and getting things done. In ways large and small, they become more successful and well worth emulating. And the way you outline the book, you talk about the West Wing and the Senate, and then a critical actor in the White House and the executive office and the judiciary. So you kind of pull together the political aspect. And then you move into the public and private elements of how women are expanding and reaching critical mass. You talk about the layman sisters, law enforcement, and the military, and your reflections on the electoral challenges and also cultural challenges. As you reflect on what you've now moved into with Memory Well, what is your thought about women and your, you know, like this is a huge next step for you to leap into taking charge of your own destiny through Memory Well?
Yeah, it is. It's, and you know, I think to some degree, I'm going from an area where women had arguably reached critical mass to some degree. Certainly, you know, covering the White House, covering campaigns, there's a lot of women, you know, definitely more than 20, 30% out there doing that these days. In fact, I would say the White House press corps is probably more like 40 or 40 plus percent women at this point. But to going to an area of startups and Silicon Valley and sort of technology, which is very much not anywhere near critical mass, and so it's been definitely an experience for me, and I think it's been a little bit eye opening to see, you know, what it's like when women are struggling. And I when I first started Memory Well, obviously it was 2016, at the end of 2016, going into 2017. I think there, we hadn't, you know, we had the Women's March and things like that, but you didn't have the Me Too movement the way that you do now. And I think when I first started to go to Silicon Valley, out to San Francisco and talk to folks about raising money, you know, I still had guys say to me, you know, hey, do you have a male co-founder? Like, and, you know, as if I couldn't start a business on my own because I was a woman. That seemed really crazy to me. And I think it was, it's amazing how much, even in the last year or two, how much it's changed. All the pieces that have been written in the New York Times and in other places about this sort of bro culture of Silicon Valley and about how hard it is, I think has certainly hit home. And now it's hard to imagine anybody saying that to me in San Francisco anymore. But it's certainly a challenging, I think, atmosphere still to raise money as a woman. Less than 5% and or 7%, depending on which study you look at, of venture capital is given to women, women-run companies. And, you know, you certainly, I think less than 3% of venture capitalists are women. So there's, you know, there's still a lot of work to do in this particular industry. And it's so it'll be interesting moving forward, like as we grow, how that, you know, how things change, hopefully. And maybe I'll maybe I'll watch another industry reach critical mass in my lifetime, which would be exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, and you're playing with the big boys.
Yeah.
I mean, you found an area where, you know, there needs to be more women, and you're bringing them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it to some degree, it has helped, I think, having written a book about women in the workforce. And certainly, talking to other women in Silicon Valley, it is something that, you know, that they are very interested in and understanding critical mass and intersectionality and those issues. It can begin a lot of conversations. And I think in general, so many of the issues that I deal with, particularly issues of caregiving, are issues that very much involve women and are very closely related to a lot of the issues in my book. So the idea that, you know, 2/3 of caregivers are women, and the sort of caregiving epidemic that we're facing right now, where we don't have enough, we're short 1.5 million caregivers by 2030, the year that the last of the baby boomer generation will turn 70. So just as the need is the greatest, we'll be short 4 million caregivers. And
wow.
You know, all of that caregiving will most likely be done by women who will have to leave their jobs to do it. And that potentially can really set women back from a lot of the strides that they've and advances that they've made in the last couple of decades to reach critical mass in the workforce. It might potentially pull them back and sort of, you know, pull them out of critical mass as they have to go home and care for their seniors.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, just because you reach the critical mass numbers maybe now, it doesn't guarantee that they'll stay that way.
For sure. Certainly in the Senate, you know, the Senate reached critical mass, arguably, in the 114th Congress, which was between 2012 and 2014, when women chaired or ranked, meaning they were the top Republican or Democrat, on 11 of the 20 committees. And so they were very, very powerful. And they really changed the culture of that institution enormously during that two-year session. And they ended up producing more than 75% of the legislation that was passed into law that session. So they batted, obviously, well above their weight, given that they were only 20% of the institution. But, you know, in the next Congress after that, when Democrats lost the majority, there were only 2 Republican women, in fact, only 1 Republican woman who was a chair of a committee. And it really set them back, and they no longer had critical mass in that institution. So you really need, like, you know, I've said this a lot, but I think that you need both Republicans and Democrats, women on both sides of the aisle, in order to truly make strides. It can't just be really lopsided, and progress can't be one side and not the other. You need to have partners that you can reach out to across the aisle to make deals, to trust, to build relationships with. And if it's all one side that are women and the other side is all men, that doesn't work. It has to be both. So
yeah.
I think that's another one of the biggest risks to the progress that we've made is that the progress has been politically so lopsided.
And you mentioned in your book that in your mother's era, women had to prove that they were as good as men and capable of leading and wielding power. And in our generation, our competence is not disputed. The question is, what kind of difference can we make? Does the presence of women in the boardroom, on the police force, and in the judiciary change what issues are focused on or how things are done? Do outcomes change when women are in charge? And if so, do they change for the better?
Absolutely. I mean, the book has study after study after study that shows that women very much change the content of the conversation. They change the outcomes of those conversations once you reach that tipping point, once you reach critical mass. And that goes whether you're in a court, like a federal court or a district court, which is a group bench. So sometimes it's, you know, 4 or 5 judges, sometimes it's 7 judges, sometimes it's 9 judges. But when you have that critical mass of women on that court, they tend to hear more cases of bias, more cases of discrimination. They tend to hear, and they tend to decide more for those plaintiffs when you have women minority voices who understand what it's like to be a minority, to understand what it's like to be discriminated against and biased against, as voices on that court and advocating for that perspective. And so there's plenty of evidence that shows that. In fact, there's evidence that goes so far to say that even Having more justices who have daughters on the bench really changes their perspective on prosecuting certain kinds of cases, particularly cases of sexual violence and rape. So, you know, obviously, there's tons of evidence that shows the difference that women make on corporate boards. There's time and time again, every study under the sun says that it isn't just sort of a nice thing to have diversity, right? It actually is the best way of doing business. It builds you a much more solid business. It makes you much more prepared for the downsides. Having diversity of thought and opinion really it can be challenging, obviously. It challenges executives to think of different things, to take into account different perspectives, but that is healthier, and it makes them better prepared for real life challenges, because inevitably the market will present those challenges naturally anyway. That's the point of the market, right, is to test the feasibility and weaknesses and strengths of companies. And so having those women voices reach enough credibility on those boards to be heard, every study under the sun shows that that makes for a much, much better board and a much better company, much more profitable across the board, much better run, and certainly deliver better dividends to stakeholders or shareholders.
Absolutely, yeah. I quote in your book, you talk about. So all the women have, regarding the Senate and the executive office, that all the women have stories of overcoming sexism and marginalization. Token minorities always face such challenges. They are overlooked, discounted, and shut out. Their presence is considered an anomaly and temporary, so there's little effort to accommodate them. The message, don't get too comfortable, you won't be staying. So women were kept out of certain caucuses and rooms, and they didn't even get their own bathroom off the Senate until 1993. Males interrupted women on the Senate floor, interrupting, claiming the lack of knowledge or experience on issues. How did Dianne Feinstein, Senator of California, how did she address that issue? She was kind of clever in how she...
Yeah, Di-Fi, I mean, she had this great, there's a great story about her. It's actually happened twice. Once was on the Senate floor and once was in committee relatively recently. It was only a few years ago, but it was similar stories. The one that happened on the Senate floor was, I believe it was 1993 or 1994. They were, the Senate was debating the ban on assault weapons. And Larry Craig, who was a senator from Idaho, was on the floor, and he was sort of expounding on the importance of guns, being from a rural state, and, you know, was very pro Second Amendment. And Senator Feinstein, I think of her as Di-Fi. I think everybody in Washington ends up calling her Di-Fi, but Di-Fi got up on the floor and said, you know, point of order, could I ask the senator a question? And he sort of said, pipe down, little lady. You know, let the big men speak here. I know about which I am talking, and you clearly don't know anything. And she sort of said, well, you know, that's ludicrous. Not only do I know very much about gun violence, but I was, you know, I became mayor after the mayor was assassinated in front of me, and along with Harvey Milk, and, you know, in a bout of gun violence, and my husband was threatened with gun violence, and, you know, and I have lived through assassinations, and I've seen firsthand the effect of gun violence. And she sort of bat him down, and Larry Craig kind of tail between his legs said, oh, okay, thank you. And kind of was sorry and left the floor. But it was one of those really just great moments where you have this man sort of talking down to you saying, like, you don't know anything. And she sort of says, no, I know a lot more than you.
Yeah. And you have another example too of Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. She has experienced a lot of slights and insults and dismissive behavior of men toward women. So you express in the book that she was riding an elevator, and she had an exchange in there, and the elevator was just for senators only. Do you remember that story?
I do. She tells the story. So she was getting into an elevator and with a staff member of hers, and the senator sort of looked up and barked at her and said, this is for senators only. And I think her aide actually said, not Senator Klobuchar, but her aide actually said, no, Senator Klobuchar, is actually a senator. And he just sort of looked chagrined and kind of embarrassed. And then, as soon as the doors opened, kind of got out of the elevator. And there was something she said after that.
She said the women are, I don't know if it was exactly the same about that, but you had another, some comment that she made about the women are incredibly positive force because we like each other. So this was more about her work, you know, that they work together and they look for common ground. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, had the acceptance speech on January 3rd in 2019 about that comment. But I don't think that you were referring to that.
No, here it is. She said...
What page is it on?
It's on 32, but I didn't actually have the quote, but she there's a quote after that, which in my memory of the telling of the story where she sort of quipped at him, you know, kind of like, don't let the door hit you on the way out a little bit. This happens a lot. You know, you have Senator Kelly Ayotte, who is, you know, a Republican from New Hampshire, who is sitting through these little trains that go back and forth between the Senate office buildings underground and the Capitol. And she was on the little train with like Marco Rubio, and both of them were freshmen just coming in for orientation. And one of the staffers sort of said to Marco Rubio, oh, don't forget to have your wife register. And he sort of looked at her and she looked at him and said, he's like, no, she's not my wife. This is Senator Ayotte, and of course the staffer was really embarrassed. Things like that. It happens all the time because they just did the first reaction, the first sense of isn't that this must be a woman senator? It's that it must be a spouse or a staffer, right? Like, and that is, you know, I think slowly changing, but certainly I think was very much the norm even until just a couple of years ago. So.
Yeah, and that brings us to Nancy Pelosi and her ability to influence. She's the most influential, unified person in caucus history, getting the bailout and the Affordable Care Act passed. Her characteristics that you address as having personal charm. I like that you addressed these situations kind of a matter-of-fact a format, but also you seem in how you talk, also, you know, you talk the way you write, very optimistic about the future. And you're not, you don't seem to be diminished by understanding and learning all these different aspects of how we're not equal.
Well, I tried to write a hopeful book in the sense that I felt that I had read so many women's books or seen so many women's books that were super doom and gloom and really depressing and sort of like, we're never going to get there. And, you know, and it was, I decided that I wanted to write something that really collected the progress that we had made thus far. And I know certainly from my personal experience that I felt like, you know, when I was younger, I never thought that, you know, I sort of viewed parity as kind of high in the sky and we'd never really get there. And I was really surprised to learn of the existence of critical mass, that the idea that, you know, you only needed to reach this sort of tipping point of 20 to 30% in order to really make a difference. And for me, it was sort of like, oh, well, we're almost there across the board everywhere, right? Like, and I really got interested in the idea of, well, what happens when you get there? And then seeing Washington get there, seeing the public sector arrive at critical mass now, it really was powerful. And then to see in the subsequent years since the book has been written, aspects of the private sector reach that tipping point. You know, I have a chapter on Hollywood where, you know, I talk about how I think when I wrote the book, women were at 23% of Hollywood producers and how close they were to critical mass. And once they reached that tipping point, how the culture of, the sort of casting couch culture of Hollywood would definitely change. And then lo and behold, what, a year and a half after the book was published, you had Harvey Weinstein, right? You had this whole sort of purging of these really gross men in Hollywood who sort of really encapsulated that casting couch culture. And that culture is now gone, right? Like, and so And so you've seen Hollywood reach critical mass. You've seen a lot of the media reach critical mass with everybody from the head of CBS, Les Moonves, to Bill O'Reilly being taken down by women sort of coming out and saying that yeah. they were abused and sort of and harassed by these men. And so I think that it's so wonderful to see that tipping point realized, right, across the board. And it's not really across the board. And I should be careful to say that because, you know, having seen it in these cultures, then you also hear it from so many other corners. And when I've spoken about the book across the country, I've had so many other women come to me and say, we're so far away from it in my industry. Like, we're never going to get there in my industry. And whether it's, you know, banking or even science, parts of engineering, it's really hard, I think, you know, Wall Street for sure. I think it's really hard for a lot of those folks because there's this feeling that they're never going to get there or it's going to be such a long time before they do. But I just have to say, at least for me, it gives me hope to see that we are having this conversation in so many different corners and that there are places where we are standing up and saying, no, this is not acceptable. And we are changing those cultures. And I hope that it isn't something that falls backwards. I hope that it's something that we retain and build on and really empower our own voices in ways that I think we're only realizing that we weren't being heard or we're only realizing
right.
how little we were being heard to begin with.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're absolutely, well, you're part of the history. And I think having the experience of you reflecting on your mother's life or me reflecting on my mother's life or all of our listeners reflecting on their mother's lives and how women are today and then how the younger generation is coming up, that we need to bridge the gap of information and the communication part. And that even brings more meaning to your memory well. You know, capturing the important stories will help us from slipping backwards.
I hope so. I'm for sure.
Yeah. I know we covered a lot. Yeah. All right. I was just curious about why Oprah wasn't mentioned in your book, along with Shonda Rhimes and Catherine Bigelow.
You know, I probably should have. It was, to be honest, like that Hollywood chapter kind of snuck in under the radar. I added that chapter and one about it was really just about Hollywood. I have to think about this. I added that in October of 2015. It was like 3 months before publication, and it was the kind of thing where, I mean, we had chapters like that I really wish I could have done on women in diplomacy. You know, I interviewed Madeleine Albright for that. I interviewed parts of my interview with Hillary Clinton were going towards that chapter. I interviewed women in the CIA, which was really cool. Like, you know, who'd reached critical mass, like more than I think almost 40%, 47% actually of the CIA is women. And then I think more than 30% or 35% of their leadership is women. So like the CIA was very proud of the fact that like they've got, you know, really they've reached critical mass. And so there were all these other chapters that I really wish I'd had time to get to, but there was a real push to get the book out ahead of the Iowa caucuses. And because of Hillary and Carly Fiorina's candidacies. And so it just wasn't possible to finish everything. And I think that there's tons of voices I wish I could have included in all of it. But there's only so many interviews I could do. There was only so many people I could touch on, before it was just like kind of cramming everything in. So,
well, you cover, a ton of women in here. How many, was it, over 100?
There are over, I think, 200 total women that I spoke to. So ranging from 4-star generals to police chiefs to CEOs to obviously senators and governors. And so, yeah, I mean, there's presidential candidates. I mean, there's definitely a large sort of swath of Hollywood producers. I mean, it kind of spans the gamut. I wish I'd had more time to include even chapters on, for example, and I mention it in the book, but I don't kind of flesh it out as much as I wish I could have had time to, but the idea of traditionally women's professions like teaching and nursing, and how in the wake of the global financial crisis in 2008, those became more and more men entered into those careers because it was called a man session. A lot more men lost their jobs in that downturn than women. Mm-hmm. And the sort of idea of the glass escalator, right? Like in those industries where because women are so trained to hear men's voices over women's voices, those men actually were promoted a lot more quickly and a lot more artificially, not having the credentials for the promotions than their female counterparts because they were men. And so it's certainly, you know, there's lots of areas where I wish I'd had time to get to it. And just unfortunately, the timeline of the book prevented that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of, I understand it better now, because I'm like, she is the first woman to own her own cable channel.
Yeah, no, she was like, I think wasn't she the first self-made Black billionaire? I think she was.
Yeah. Well, I remember that there was a book written about I'm drawing a blank with her name. She was allowed, big television person. She was allowed to be in a leadership role, but not allowed to have stock in a cable company. It was USA Network.
Oh, wow. I don't know that story. I don't think.
Okay. But anyway, I was just struck by, so once women hit, got to a level of leadership in an executive role, that they weren't quite, qualified enough to have stock ownership. So when she left, she still was making, you know, a ton of money, but compared to her counterparts, she felt like she could have done a lot more had she been able to have some stock in the company.
Oh, I think I remember reading a story about this, but yes, I knew what you're talking about. Yeah, there's so many wonderful stories out there. Like, I loved the stories of Good Girls Revolt. You know that television series on, unfortunately got canceled, but I think it was on Amazon Studios, about the women in the 70s in the television, sort of news television era, and how they sort of led this revolt. Literally, they kind of went on strike in order to get more access to being on air and to doing stories and stuff. So there's great stories like that that I wish I could have included, and I knew about them, but again, you know, there's only so much you can fit in a book, and it is what it is. Like, I fit as much as I possibly could into it.
Well, I think everyone should read this book. I just think it gives a broad perspective of how we're making progress toward equality and the areas that we need to become more aware of. And this isn't just a book for women. I think that men could create and gather a lot of value in understanding, you know, kind of what women experience, because we all have women in our lives. And I think it would bring a deeper degree of empathy towards the career lives. Could you read, as we close out, the last paragraph of your book?
201.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps my mother's sense of her own destiny was grander than the world she lived in would allow. What if she'd been born 30 years later? Would she have been the first female UN Secretary General? I think she very well could have, or at the very least, she would have found kindred female spirits, allies among the diplomatic ranks, women who could help her smooth out the rough spots of a still oppressively sexist international climate. There is a regular gathering of women in diplomacy in Washington called Diplo Babes. I have sometimes imagined my mother in such a gathering. How would it have helped her? Women are not there yet by any means, but reaching broad influence means that we're no longer struggling, isolated, and alone as my mother had been. And I like to think that she too would find, as I have, that in numbers comes safety and power.
It's beautiful. Thank goodness for your mother.
Mm, Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. I'm getting all choked up. I just think that's a... your mother's journey must have been so difficult. So,
Well,
yeah. So, and for you to just put the whole thing in context for yourself and figure out and navigate your way through it because you didn't understand and didn't have all the information. And she wasn't able to talk about it in a way that I guess would help you have a closer relationship with her.
Yeah, I mean, I knew it, like, and I think it's really my father who translated a lot of it for us, you know, as good fathers do, and between mothers and daughters to some degree. But right. I think that, you know, he helped me understand her in ways that she often couldn't express to me herself. And I think that, you know, I sometimes think that she would be appalled that I wrote this book because she was always the one who said, don't be the woman's woman. Like, don't let them corner you in and like write about women, that kind of thing, which I think early on in my career, I did really sort of eschew the idea of being like, you know, I don't want to be kind of boxed into covering women. And I definitely did roll my eyes when my editor assigned me the women's story. I was coming back from, you know, spending time in Syria and Iraq. And all of a sudden he's like, well, write a story about the women in the Senate. And I was like, really? I was the only woman on staff for time in Washington at that point. And I sort of was like, you really have to assign the woman's story. And I kind of rolled my eyes. But I think that I, you know, ultimately had to thank him for assigning me that story because it turned out to be such a powerful and transformational story in my life. And I think that,
I think you found solidarity with women.
Yeah, I think it made me grow and made me sort of less embarrassed about being the woman writing about women and embracing the idea of writing about women and saying, you know what, I'm not, like, I've proven myself. I've been to Iraq and Syria. I've written, I've covered, you know, presidents and presidential campaigns, and I've covered, you know, everything. And I should be allowed to write about women, and I should embrace it and want to write about it because that is my experience in life. And I did so. And I think that, I think it really changed my perspective in the world and really empowered me. And I hoped that if she had lived long enough, if she had lived in a different era, like I said at the end of the book, that she might also have had experienced the same sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for our meaningful conversation and very enriching. And I hope it motivates you enough to finish your grant tonight.
Yes, thank you. I'm with a long night of grant writing ahead of me, which is nowhere near as fun as book writing. So,
right. I can imagine.
I really appreciate you having me on. It was a lovely conversation. Thank you.
Okay. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer. Mon frère from another mother. All right. Take care, everybody. Work hard this week and find a way to bring a meaningful conversation in the workplace with women. Try that out. All right. See you next week. Bye.